KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Tomorrow, chance of showers. Tonight's low 37, tomorrow's high 43.
South Lake Union is a designated urban center. It is where we intend to put a large amount of housing in the future.
Parents will tell their kids, don't talk to strangers. And parents take this very seriously and make their kids scared of strangers. And that's totally the wrong advice. You know, this myth of a strange kidnapper in a white van, that never happens.
That's what being honest is on stage. And I don't own truth, but I own my truth. And whatever I believe, I want to make sure it's clear that the audience knows what I stand for.
That was Harry Kondabolu, who is a comedian. We're going to talk to him. You heard Ken Jennings in there. He's got a new book, Because I Said So, The Truth Behind the Myths, Tales, and Warnings Every Generation Passes Down to Its Kids. And we start with the question of South Lake Union. The proposed upzone of the South Lake Union neighborhood brings more changes to an already transformed neighborhood in Seattle. Vulcan, the developer, and the city want to put three 24-story towers along Valley across from South Lake Union Park. What effect would they have on popular views to the Space Needle, private planes landing on the water, and the mix of housing around the neighborhood? Peter Steinbrück does not like the proposed renewal. His father, he is a former city council member, an architect, the holder of a famous last name associated with pushing back the forces of urban renewal. His father, Victor, helped lead the fight to save the Pike Place Market. Good to see you, sir.
Good morning, Steve. That's a nice introduction. Thank you.
and now we'll go on.
Okay.
Peter Steinbrück is working partly pro bono for the owners of the Mirabella, a retirement community on Fairview that worries about its views, as well as the Cascade Community Council, many residents and businesses in the area. They're calling themselves the South Lake Union Community Coalition. He's also been working against the Soto Arena in that neighborhood, supported by the Port of Seattle and the Manufacturing Industrial Council.
Good morning. Yes.
Just want to make sure we got our cards on the table.
Fairly accurate. Yes.
What? Oh, that's right. You want to say looking for a new place for the arena.
That's is that right. The accurate? Well, I just don't think the arena should go in the industrial heart of the industrial area. We're not on that subject. Okay, that's another topic.
I'll be back for that one. All right. So it looks like you are trying to slow down development a little bit in the city of Seattle, or growth in certain places. Does that mean a Mayor Steinbrück administration would be a kind of a slow growth cap style administration?
Well, that's funny. It didn't take you long to spring that one on me, Steve. No, I'm not about slow growth. I'm about good growth. And this is not good growth in South Lake Union. It's bad growth. It's bad, poor city planning. And so I think we can do a much better job. This is a beautiful, beautiful, growing city. It deserves to have the best planning and attention to good design that we can offer. And we've got a lot of talent here in that regard.
Decided whether you're running for mayor yet?
That decision will be for another day.
All right.
I'm seriously thinking about it, and no denial there.
All right. Let's talk about that. Those three towers.
Sure.
That's the focus of your attention at this point. I know it's the whole neighborhood. But look, growth has to come somewhere. Valley Street is going to be this beautiful area where we can just walk right over through buttons that will respond easily to control traffic so that we can walk into the new South Lake Union Park. The developers say, look, it's just what we said, a large box on the bottom of about four or five stories, and then it'll be a skinny tower just on one part of the block.
Well, there's a lot that is not accurate in that statement. These are not skinny towers. They're over a third larger than the so-called pencil towers in Vancouver in terms of the floor plates.
A third larger.
They're 12,500 square feet floor plates. Vancouver's is closer between 6,000 and 8,000. They have big boxy bread boxes at the base, 85 feet, which is
eight stories
at the base that could cover the full block. And they block views. They block. They put cast long shadows over the Lake Union Park, they cause the flight path that has been in place for 70 years for float planes to be shifted to the west, forcing planes to take a right angle. Why would we do all this for one developer that has very deep pockets in South Lake Union?
I believe you just answered your own question.
Well, it's the jackpot, I think, when you consider how much of a concession is being given for these luxury towers that are proposed at the foot of South Lake Union.
All right, well, let me ask you three things on that. Let's start with the shadows, just because real quickly. I mean,
sure.
Yeah, shadows get cast by buildings. I mean, where don't they get cast by buildings? We're not so worried about it 10 blocks up in the where they're building towers along Denny.
We have a city policy that we don't intentionally impose long shadows on public spaces, particularly parks. That is a city policy. And in this case, the studies are available to look at for anyone who wants to dig into the EIS. And in the wintertime, these towers will impose significant darkness.
For how long?
Throughout the winter.
Now, come on.
Throughout the day, throughout the winter. Go ahead and look for yourself the final EIS for the South Lake Union rezone.
All right, and then the Kenmore Air. If that happens, yep. I mean, businesses get inconvenienced all the time. Why should
this
they
is not
be
just
inconvenienced?
A business. It's an international airport, and there's grave safety issues on South Lake on the lake.
That's a pretty big
boating.
Claim for Kenmore Air. I understand they do go to Canada, but that's still
there are private planes and there are other seaplanes that use the lake. The point is, there's already a serious a risk of between marine vessels, between boats and kayaks. And seaplanes, and this flight path will make matters worse there.
All right. Well, this is an industrial lake. I was looking at how little of that lake is public shoreline, and how we have decided over the last couple hundred years that I guess we don't care about Lake Union because it's all private yachts or big AGC buildings and other buildings that just go out over the edge of this lake. We got one little area that's public on the south end, a few public areas in north end, plus gasworks. We've sort of written off Lake Union. Now we're going to get it back in part because we're going to have people living there.
Steve, we haven't written it off. We have the Cheviot Trail. We have the future Northwest Native Canoe Center that's planned for South Lake Union. We have Mohai Museum of Industry and History moving in. And we have a densifying population that will use all of those public amenities. Let's protect them and let's do what we can to create an appealing pedestrian environment in our public spaces. We need that with density.
All right, how high would you go? How would you build those three? Let's just stick with those three blocks. Would you build them as an architect?
Well, if we're going to have towers there, I'd make the floor plates much skinnier, and so they truly could be claimed skinny towers.
Now, they're not doing that? 68,000?
Maximum profits. Bigger the floor plate. Those are fantastic views that will be exclusively for those tower residents.
So that's
at the
only reason.
Cost of everybody else.
But that's the only reason you think it's just a maximizing of profit? There's no city ordinance reason?
Oh, no, of course. And it's not necessary to meet density goals for South Lake Union. Far from it. I would bring the tower heights down. They're too tall. They're 24 stories. And they contravene a longstanding principle that buildings step down to the water. We did that with downtown, with the rezone which I led for downtown. The buildings step down to the water. And that preserves territorial views for everyone, not just private views. I think they should be brought down. There's no magic number, but I would say, 8 to 10 stories would be reasonable.
8 to 10 stories for the entire if you built
at
a tower.
The foot of Lake Union, yeah. No, yeah. 120 feet, perhaps. But smaller floor plates.
And then how about what would you do at the sidewalk level? What buildings should be built there?
Oh, probably no more than 65 feet, 5 stories at the base. And you could put residential, you could put mixed use at the base and activate the street life there. So this is just not good city planning. And it puts zoning capacity on steroids because it's 3 times what's needed to meet the density goals under the Seattle Comprehensive Plan, and it puts zoning up for sale to the highest bidder.
Do you agree with this number that says if we built it, the rezone would bring 24,000 more residential units, 30,000 more jobs by, 2030?
Well, 2031, that's my point. Our comprehensive plan only goes to 2024, and there's been no council approval for those growth targets. They're fictional. They've been imagined, and they're wishful. But I don't know what the actual outcomes will be, but I know that there's plenty of growth capacity in South Lake Union today without even making any zoning changes.
So you would step it down, 8 to 10 stories. What would you do in the block behind it? What would you do on the Mercer block or the other blocks as it goes back towards Denny?
Well, much of the South Lake Union area has been built out, and I led much of the zoning of the past for Amazon, for the Seattle Mixed. And I also did the designation of South Lake Union as an urban center. And there is an established urban form there that I think is workable and has created an attractive and dynamic urban environment today. Why
do
mess
you?
With that?
Yes, do you? I do. And what are those urban forms that you like in that South Lake Union neighborhood?
Well, what I'm speaking of is the general stepping down toward the lake that exists today from downtown Seattle. And what this does is it turns it upside down. In fact, it creates a donut hole in the middle where Amazon is. And we just did the rezoning for Amazon a few years ago.
I thought it was still higher for Amazon at that point. Is that lower than 24 stories?
The Amazon zoning, again, I led that on the council, and I'm proud of that, is in the range of 65 feet. And this would put it up to 240 feet. But the point is, those buildings are not going to be changed. I mean, they were just built. And so what you create is a big cavity in the middle.
I see.
That's not good urban form.
A virtual donut hole.
Exactly.
Not a zone.
Yeah, and the claim that the city's rezone, the mayor's rezone, is stepping down is just a complete hogwash. It does the opposite of that.
All right. Mirabella, those folks want to protect their views. The other folks that are up in the upper part of the neighborhood, they just want to protect their views, and that's why you don't want to go up.
Well, it's more than just protecting views. It's neighborhood character. They've gutted our preservation strategy, so historic preservation is a loser in this.
Who's they?
The mayor's rezone and the proponents of it. There's multiple problems with this rezone. It also has no serious mitigation for the loss of affordable housing and the future needs for diverse affordable housing is another issue. I'm just not finding anything that's particularly wonderful and compelling about this rezone. And I think it's developer-driven to cash out on exclusive views at the foot of South Lake Union.
Well,
I don't blame them for trying. You know, any good developer is going to go for it. But it shouldn't. Zoning should not be put up for sale, for one thing.
On the, I'm going to go through three things here real fast, because you went through on the idea of what happens on Valley at street level. You think it should be no more than like 5 stories? Is that what you said? And then maybe another 4 or 5 stories as a tower inside that.
Something like that, I think, would be
long.
Far more reasonable than what's proposed today.
Block.
I think would be workable in terms of opening up the views, not casting long shadows on the park throughout much of the winter months, September through June, in fact, not causing this enormous diversion of air traffic to South Lake Union, and appropriate scale for pedestrian neighborhood.
How much,
the park,
so. How much does that reduce the number of people over 20 years? What would we say, 24,000 more residential units?
Not at all, because there are plenty of other areas where more towers could be located that don't have those impacts.
Where?
South Lake Union is 345 acres.
I know. Where do you like? Dexter? What areas
from Denny,
are you looking
at? From Denny on down, the point is there is ample capacity. We're not saying no rezone, no increased density. We're saying it can be done much better and more sensitively to preserve an entire neighborhood of people who live, work, and play in South Lake Union.
Well, could you
phrase?
Could you build those towers one block to the south along Mercer, or is that still too close to
the
lake?
No. The point is that the area is relatively flat, and that is one of the arguments in favor of stepping down from downtown. Not bringing downtown to South Lake Union, which is what is embodied in the mayor's proposal.
So you like it? You like the Amazon height as high as it is and then going down towards the
exactly.
lake from there?
Exactly. And I'm not saying that's great architecture there, but it serves a great purpose, which is the housing, a growth industry.
Why do we get that kind of architecture in that neighborhood?
Why? Well, they had to throw that up very quickly, I'll just say that, and because of their office needs and their expansion needs. I think, you know, we have all kinds of architecture in the city. We have great architects. We can do better through design review and be more sensitive. That's another issue, which is an aesthetic one.
What historic preservation is being lost in that neighborhood? Isn't most all the historic buildings been torn down?
Sure. This is an issue that has gotten little airtime, and there are dozens of smaller sites that are eligible for historic designation status. The mayor's rezone guts the incentives that protect historic landmarks that would protect them, such as the transfer of development rights for unused development over those sites. And it favors 2 sites only, exclusively, which is the Seattle Times block and the Troy Laundry, which is owned by a developer. And so because they have set a limit, a maximum size requirement in order to be eligible for these incentives, all other properties, and there are 14 designated landmarks in South Lake Union. Only two of them, the ones I mentioned, qualify under the mayor's rezone in a way that is showing favoritism to two corporate ownerships.
When you say designated, does that mean those are preserved or only designated to be preserved?
They are preserved, but they can transfer their unused development rights to another site and get cash for it.
And then the building gets torn down?
No, it stays. But under this rezone, everything goes up, and those sites are low heights, so they sell the development rights over the air rights, as it's called. And my point is there are 12 other designated landmarks that don't qualify under the mayor's rezone because they're too small. The mayor's rezone requires 60,000 square feet for a designated landmark to transfer its air rights. Right. Only two of those qualify.
All right, last issue in 2 minutes. The proposal is that there'd be some land swaps and some cost swaps, and the city would end up with a block closer to Highway 99 where they could then find the money to build low-income housing there. Is that enough? Is that a good deal?
This is a monopoly board is what's going on here, and I think you're referring to Block 59, which is partially owned by Vulcan. They would trade that for the right to build these tall, bulky towers at the foot of the lake. They're not giving anything away, believe me.
Yeah, the city would have to pay for it, some of the land.
The city would have to pay for the development for social services and potentially affordable housing because nobody's contributing to that. Vulcan transfers the land rather than paying cash in the bonus system that incentivizes housing that is required to get to these maximum heights.
Believe me,
there's no gift involved here. In fact, Vulcan bought the properties for a third of what they want to sell them for now from the city in the early 2000s.
But when you say sell, you're actually saying they transfer it back to the city.
Yeah, they transfer it back in lieu of cash payments.
I see. And then why can't we ask developers in this city who are going to build large luxury towers that they are required to put in percentage of affordable or low-income housing in those towers?
I think you're referring to inclusionary requirements. I think most developers would prefer not to have that constraint on their development, and they claim that it detracts from the marketability to have lower-income people living in the same building with, you know, high-end luxury units. I don't have a strong opinion about that. I know that many housing advocates do and care deeply that we should be mixing the affordability on site with the, you know, project by project as opposed to paying cash for it.
All right. So are you going to be like Ed Murray and just create an exploratory committee to consider?
Absolutely not. I will not be tentative. I will be confident and prepared and certain about my plans.
All right. Peter Steinbrück, he is working on issues in South Lake Union, also working on issues around the arena proposal, and he's thinking about politics again. Thank you, sir.
Thanks very much.
This is Weekday.
Okay.
Parents give their kids a lot of warnings, things like sugar makes you hyper, or if you cross your eyes, they'll stay like that. But are these sayings actually true? We'll get some answers from trivia champion Ken Jennings. That's coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from Chinook Book, featuring goods and services from more than 500 local merchants in Seattle and the Puget Sound area, dedicated to building an economy that supports small businesses helping community organizations. More at chinookbook.net.
We have cloudy skies and 47 degrees in the U District. We're expecting a high today in the upper 40s. Clouds and showers expected the rest of today. It's going to be cloudy tonight and tomorrow. Chance of showers. Tonight's low in the upper 30s, tomorrow's high in the low 40s.
Did your parents tell you the truth when you were growing up? Always wear a coat, don't lick a pole, eat everything on your plate. Maybe, maybe not. Ken Jennings has been thinking about that. He's written, "Because I Said So, The Truth Behind the Myths, Tales, and Warnings Every Generation Passes Down to Its Kids." He is also author of Maphead and a Jeopardy champion, and he lives in our area. It's good to see you again, sir.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, Steve.
I like this book because I keep wanting to take off these little stickies that appear to be on this book, and there's these little stickies in the graphic, and there's one that has a little poison mark there. Just to remind us that some of these are serious issues.
Parenting is serious business. I think that's why parents, you know, spout so many of these little harassing little nags at us, because they're worried that they're not doing it right.
Well, this book is it's like PolitiFact. It's PolitiFact for
fact-checking mom and dad. That's right.
Yeah. Never run with scissors. That sounds reasonable.
It's good advice.
You're saying it's almost true. Right. Mostly true.
Scissors are overhyped. I looked at some emergency room data, and it turns out almost all scissor-related injuries are to the fingers. So it's cutting with scissors that are actually the tricky part. Running is relatively safe. You see more banister-related injuries than scissor-related injuries in American hospitals.
So basically, it's don't use scissors is what parents should be saying.
Yeah, you need to be more protective. Put your kid in bubble wrap. Never let them use those round plastic kindergarten scissors.
Stop opening the door and peeking in the oven. All the heat goes out.
Oh, my mom would always harp on this on Thanksgiving and stuff. It's actually not true. Most of the heat in an oven radiates from the walls. So, your kid can leave the oven for an open for a minute trying to grab a cookie, and as soon as he shuts it, the heat goes back up in less than a minute.
Sugar rots your teeth?
That one's sort of true, but sort of not. It turns out that sugar, any kind of starch, is equally bad for your teeth. So carbohydrates are just as bad. And in fact, carbohydrates stick to your teeth more than sugar does. Sugary snacks tend to wash right away. So a sandwich is probably worse than a cookie or a candy bar.
What?
I'm sorry.
You're changing everything. So basically, I should brush my teeth a lot.
You need to brush your teeth.
All right. This one, though. This one here. Stay out of the cookie dough, you'll get worms. I have never heard that.
Really?
What parent says that to their children?
Well, the funny thing
is, kind of cookie dough are they serving their children?
It's got worms. Well, I mean, it doesn't have worms, but, you know, the government will tell you today, no raw eggs whatsoever. No hollandaise, no eggnog, no cookie dough, because there's risk of salmonella. When you look at the numbers, it's actually incredibly low. You'll face maybe one salmonella egg in your lifetime by the averages. And really, I mean, what's better than cookie dough for a kid? You don't want to rob kids of these simple pleasures.
I see. So it's the egg they're worried about.
Right.
Not the chocolate chips or the flour.
Well, that's funny that you say that. The only case on record of cookie dough actually causing poisoning, food poisoning, it was the flour that was bad and not the eggs after all. So we don't know what we're talking about.
Where did you find that? Just in your research?
Yeah, just researching news articles and journals. All the entries in here came from, you know, case-controlled experiments and academic study.
All right. Well, this one, yes. No double dipping. You'll spread germs. I think we all can agree on that.
That one turned out to be true. There's a guy at a university who's, I guess, rigorously fact-checking Seinfeld episodes. And sure enough, it turned out that you transfer tens of thousands of microbes every time you take a bite out of a carrot stick and put it back in the dip.
All right, sir. You just were wondering one day? Well, how old are your kids?
I have a 10-year-old and a 6-year-old.
So you were just wondering one day if the things you were saying were valid?
Exactly. Well, you realize when you have kids that you just lie to them all the time. And some of the lies mean well. You know, when you say that the puppy went to live on Grandpa's farm, you know, I think there's something behind that. But I think I was lying accidentally. You know, I was saying, don't sit too close to the TV. And my son would say, really? Is that true? It'll hurt my eyes. I'll go blind. And I realized, I don't know, you know, that's just what Grandma used to tell me. But you don't want to show any weakness because kids are like bears. So you're like, yes, absolutely, get back on the couch, you know.
What about that?
Not true. Temporary eye strain is the worst you can get. Your ophthalmologists say sit as close to the TV as you want, no permanent eye strain.
That's good to know because, you know, now with the new computer world, we got them right up to our noses.
Exactly. And I think it is good to know. I think it's reassuring for parents that they can sort of let go of some of this paranoia. And I think it's better for the kids, too.
Has it helped you?
Well, yeah. I feel like in my house it has not helped me because my son read the book. And now every time my wife tries to get him to do anything, he's like, he doesn't even look up. He'll be like, no, popping your knuckles is fine. It's in dad's book. But I think in general it is good to realize that parents are lousy risk assessors. You know, kids have more fun when they're allowed to climb trees and ride bikes without us hovering. And hopefully this will let parents do that.
Was that in there, climbing trees? I must have missed that part.
I don't have numbers on climbing trees. But I think in general, parents do sort of, you know, worry about kids doing the things that we always did as kids and today would freak out anyone.
You know, my parents told me that the puppy went to live on a farm. And I believed them for a long, long, long time. It was only recently I said, hey,
wait a
second. Were they making that up?
Well, I mean, this is the time of year for the Santa lie. And
what? No, I don't even want to hear that.
I mean, the Santa controversy. I want to teach the controversy here, Steve.
Teach the controversy.
And this is the first year where I think my five-year-old doesn't believe it. And I think it's because we overreached and told her about the Tooth Fairy, and she realized the whole thing was just a
house. She didn't buy the Tooth Fairy.
And that's I think that's good, you know. I mean, it's really a little bit implausible when you think about it. And you whip out the Tooth Fairy when your kids are 5 and 6 and starting to lose their teeth, and it's the exact wrong age to try to introduce one more magical gift giver.
You got to start them earlier.
That's right. You got to start lying.
let's talk about that a little bit. You don't. I don't recall in here in the book Santa, you claiming that Santa is not.
I don't fact
coming.
Check Santa. Yeah. No,
you do not fact check or the Tooth Fairy. I mean, we need some. Don't we need some? You know, fantasies in our lives to sort of give it some. Give us some things to tell stories around the campfire with.
I did feel a little bit conflicted when I had to repeat. Well, I loved Santa as a kid. It was not traumatic for me to learn that there was no Santa, but I did feel
again, a
little
claim you were making that not all of us have agreed to, but right. Go ahead.
If possibly, you know, science eventually discovers there is no Santa. But, you know, when I was telling my kids, I did feel a little bit guilty, like, oh, you know, I know it's fun, but I am technically, you know, possibly lying to them.
You are?
A little guilty. You know, they say it's good. You know, they say, for example, that most parents do have a favorite and you just have to pretend you don't. Just treat them equally. Never compare them. Pretend deep in your heart you don't have a favorite child, and that's what's best for everyone.
Are your kids listening to the radio right now?
No, they're at school. I can say whatever I want. Who's your
favorite?
I don't have. You know, this is funny. My wife and I were talking about this. In our house, it changes by the day. It's whoever's, you know, whoever's less drama that day. You're the new favorite. But we don't say that.
Oh, look. Peter Steinbrück was talking about the news report that there were bed bugs in Suzula Library, mm-hmm. reportedly. You have some bed bugs. No, you talk about sleep.
Yeah, sleep-related myths.
You call it, don't let the bed bugs bite, but you don't have any actual bed bugs, right? Well, what's wrong with some of these ideas? Early to bed, early to rise? Come on. Benjamin Franklin taught us that.
He did, you know, smart guy, but not. The funny thing is when you look at Franklin's life, he actually never got up early. He talked a good game, but the guy was up partying all night with, you know, beautiful French women and slept in. It turns out most of us are born with a chronotype that tells us if we're night owls or not, and you can't do a lot to change it.
What are you?
I'm definitely a night owl. Most of this book was written, you know.
Are you a night owl, really?
Daily Show, yeah, absolutely.
After the Daily Show?
Yeah.
Daily Show, Colbert, and then you're cranking it out.
My most productive time of day right there.
That's good to know. I did not know
it
that.
It does change over your life. I think, you know, as I get a little older, maybe I will turn into a morning guy. I don't know.
I've gotten older. I'm more of a night guy, and this job gets even harder for me.
Right.
Don't eat that right before bed. You'll have bad dreams.
I assumed that was true. Like, I feel like I've eaten Thai food and then had weird dreams. You ever have this happen?
Yes.
Not a lot of evidence for it, though. The nightmare expert I looked at, you know, he did a survey of 100 people. Only one of them reported a connection between diet and the nightmares they were having.
But you do right here. It doesn't seem impossible to me that there's some connection.
Right. In a lot of these cases, better science needs to be done. I don't have a sleep lab to test thousands of people on what happens after they eat Thai food. But, but if somebody wants to throw, you know, if somebody wants to throw me a $10,000 grant, I'll do better.
What about yawning? Yawning is true. If you're yawning.
It's there's some interesting work being done on yawning. It turns out it's not oxygen. It's more of a heat exchange mechanism. Like if your brain's overheated, you yawn. So it's actually when people yawn at each other, it's a sign that I'm trying to alert myself. I'm actually not bored with you. I'm interested in what you're saying, and I'm trying to wake my brain up a bit.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So the brain is maybe, yeah.
If someone,
when you're yawning.
If someone's talking to you and they start yawning, it's because they're passionately engaged in what you're saying.
All right. One more because I do like this. Never wake a sleepwalker.
Turns out to be true, but not for the reason you think.
What's the reason?
Have you ever heard like an old wives' tale that if you wake up a sleepwalker, they can have a heart attack immediately?
Or they'll lose their minds.
Yeah. Right. You go nuts or something. It turns out all they'll do is they'll be shocked that, you know, you woke them up and they're standing, you know, in the kitchen and they might, you know, lash out and slug you. So it's more dangerous for the waker than the wakey.
Oh,
so
just like, yeah, when you're flailing in your dreams. Yeah. Same thing, huh?
So just guide them back to bed without necessarily saying, why are you in the kitchen?
Ken Jennings has written Because I Said So. He's also written Maphead. He was a Jeopardy champion. So tell me something. When we first met, you had just finished being the Jeopardy champion. You'd moved here. You were sort of looking at what you were going to do.
Right.
You decided that you were going to be continue to in the world of trivia, if I may say it, in the most positive way.
Sure.
How come?
it's my field, you know? I feel like aptitude is sometimes destiny. And when I was a little kid, I would run home every day from school to watch Jeopardy. I would sometimes skip school so I could see more game shows. I was a trivia nut and, you know, loved to try to beat my parents at Trivial Pursuit. And, you know, I was just wired that way. And no guidance counselor ever thought that was a career. But after Jeopardy, I've had the, you know, very good fortune of being able to have this second act where I'm a professional writer, which is something I love to do, but didn't think I had a career in.
Did you come up with many more "because I said so" myths than the ones you've included here? I'm trying to count how many you have. What do you have, about 200 some odd?
There's 100 something. The hard part of the book was assembling the list, you know, because people don't think this way. You ask someone, hey, what are the weird things your parents used to tell you that you always wondered if were true? And people don't think that way. They're like, you know, your assistant who showed me into the studio wanted to know if seals could really choke on helium balloons and die, you know, because it's true. My mom said this, let your helium balloon go in a parking lot and who knows, it could be environmental damage. And I thought, oh, that's a good one. I wish that was in the book. Most of the ones I didn't do were like international ones, you know, from other cultures, like, you know, in the Philippines, they say don't wear red during a thunderstorm, you'll get hit by lightning. You know, I'm sure ours sound just as odd to them, but these things do vary by culture.
Don't you think you have a game show here?
Yeah, like a family-themed game show. Get mom and dad and the kids there and have them fight about.
Or like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has people bluff on a story.
Right.
Have you been approached yet?
I haven't. I've done quite a few game show pilots, and I'm sort of 0 for 5 or whatever. But
this is it. You own this one.
That's right.
And because I said so. Come on.
Are you going to want a piece now that you're pitching me here, Steve?
I don't want a piece so much, but I would like to maybe appear every once in a while.
No, I'd be Vanna White.
I would love to be Vanna White.
That's what we should do.
That's very good. That's because it's a nice idea. It really is. And at the same time, you're educating us.
I think it's reassuring for parents, and I think it's fun for, you know, even if you don't have kids, it's fun as a former kid to look and see what things your mom knew what she was talking about and when she was sort of, you know, making stuff up.
All right, so when you're at Elliott Bay Book Company tonight at 7, are you basically going to challenge people to tell you falsehoods that you can refute?
That would be good, actually. You know, is anybody here with their moms? I'll start some fights. I'll start some fights in the bookstore.
That's right. What did your mom always tell you? Yeah, that'd be nice. That'd be good. Ken Jennings is speaking tonight at Elliott Bay Book Company at 7 p.m. He's author of MapQuest, Charting the Wide, Weird World of Geography. Geography Wonks and Brainiac, Adventures in the Curious, Competitive, Compulsive World of Trivia Buffs. Your titles are throwing me.
Man, after the semicolon, they just keep throwing stuff in.
Because I said so, the truth behind the myths, tales, and warnings every generation passes down to its kids, which will soon be a game show coming to you with Ken Jennings as executive producer and host, and Steve Scherer's Vanna White.
Perfect.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me.
This is Weekday.
It's now legal to possess marijuana in Washington State. So what does that mean to you? If you didn't smoke pot before, will you start? How will you address the issue with your kids? KUOW's Ross Reynolds takes your phone calls on this topic at 1240 today, and we welcome your thoughts right now at our feedback line, 206-221-3663. That's 206-221-3663.
Support for KUOW comes from At a Glance Wallmates, a new line of self-adhesive dry erase planning products for the home and office. More information at ataglance.com.
They are two of the funniest people on the planet, yet Dick Cavett and Kristen Wiig could not be more different.
Dick must learn to control his talking.
And I'm the exact opposite. I hated talking in front of people.
I'm Alec Baldwin. Each week on Here's the Thing from WNYC and PRX, I talk with artists, policymakers, and performers. It's where I find out why people do what they do.
And that comes your way tonight at 7 o'clock. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. It's 9:39. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Symphony, presenting Don Tiki's Hot Lava Holiday Show on Monday, December 17th at Benaroya Hall. Tickets online at seattlesymphony.org.
Hari Kondabolu is a writer and a comedian. He received his master's in human rights from the London School of Economics. Before that, he worked for the Hate-Free Zone in Seattle as an immigrants' rights organizer. But he also thought maybe human rights, comedy. He discovered he was going to maybe focus on comedy for a while. He was discovered in Seattle in 2007, got a spot in the HBO Comedy Festival, an appearance on Jimmy Kimmel Live. Since then, he's toured around the world doing stand-up. He's been on Conan. He's a writer and a contributor to a new show, W. Camus Bell's FX show, Totally Biased. Hari has been performing at the Seattle Comedy Underground this week. And I asked him what it was like and why he was interested in coming back to perform in Seattle.
This is my lab. I come here four or five times a year. I develop the most material here. I live on the other side of the country. I commute to Seattle this often because I just think the audiences are amazing. They are incredibly smart. They're incredibly patient, so which I love because I have really long setups. I like to give information. I like to weave a story. And if you have a crowd that's drunk and tired and uninterested, I have no shot, you know. I've said this before. I'm a better, like, Wednesday night comedian. I'm, like, better when a crowd is not exhausted from the workday and drunk, or when they're not expecting a party, you know. I'm best maybe in a bookstore. And Seattle offers me that, so.
Hari Kondabolu is our guest. He's a comedian and a writer. A little more about what you mean by it being a workshop here.
Seattle?
Yeah.
I was on stage the last couple of nights at the Comedy Underground, and I was just throwing up ideas, stuff that didn't have a clear joke to it. It was a funny idea, and I was kind of riffing. And I knew that the audience, especially on a Wednesday and Thursday, would forgive me for doing it. And I have enough fans here, people who have seen my work for the last 5 years, who trust me enough where I can just throw up something and just talk it out. And it's strange because I think, especially with crowds here, it feels like I'm talking to friends. Even though I don't know everyone in the audience, there's enough trust I have of them where I can kind of navigate, like talk on stage, talk through it and see if there's an angle. And if there isn't, we'll joke about the fact, well, that didn't work.
Do you remember what it was, for example?
You know, how I was happy Obama won because I didn't want to return to a country where a white man would be president and killing brown people in other countries, and we have a brown man who could do the same thing just as well. And it's
your example of a family.
That's a hard thing because, you know, I voted for Obama. I'm obviously very left, but I think we should hold him accountable. And I think drones are these horrific things that we, for some reason, have like, well, that's a bad thing that the president is doing. And I don't support that, but this, and this. We can say what his accomplishments are, and we can appreciate them. But this is still horrific, and I think we should address it. And so I want to talk about that. I want to find a way to get more humor out of that and hold the president accountable. And I found it funny when Obama first got elected and people said, now we can't say anything funny about the president. And a lot of it was around racial lines, you know, because the black president, we can't say anything, which was kind of, to me, like, do you see kind of the racial, like, nature, like the racism in that? It's like, no, hold him accountable as the president. Like, the president is still the president of the United States, and the president of the United States has killed children in other countries for years. That's part of the job description, unfortunately. So I think having that discussion is still interesting. Making it funny can be hard, but I love the challenge of it.
Do you, when you said, is comedy is meant to be somewhat offensive, it's meant to challenge us, it's meant right. to be something that makes us think about it.
I don't know if it's meant to be. I think it can be. And I don't think it's wrong that it is. There are comics I see on stage. I don't agree with their point of view. But the fact that they're at least supporting it with what they feel is evidence and they can stand by it, I have more respect for that. What frustrates me is when I see my colleagues who argue a point of view, and if they are called on it by people, they say it's just a joke. You can't do both. You can't say it's funny because it's true and back off because it's just a joke. I would rather disagree with you and at least respect you because you stood by your point of view. And your point of view can change, certainly, you can argue both sides. So I don't mind the offensive nature. I think the offending is okay. I think it's about the thought that's put into it, the intent. Do you realize what buttons you are pushing? I don't want to get a laugh on someone else's terms. You know, I want to get a laugh on my terms. I want to write it so tightly you were laughing because of this. That's not guaranteed, but to the best of my ability.
You told a joke about the different names you were called after. Much after 9/11.
Yes,
Your point being the confusion with which people cast epithets about. You're a brown person, so therefore you are going to be cast in one place.
Yeah.
Was that an effective joke?
I think that
did
joke...
Did it serve its purpose?
That it's hard to talk vaguely, but the nature of the... in some of the joke was basically, I've been called many things. Hurry, Harry, since 9/11 I've been called. And then I used the term sand, N-word. I said the N-word. I think it was effective because it was sharp and it got right to the point of what that period of post 9/11 racism and violence was. And so there was initial reaction. And so, but the thing I realized is that I was getting these kind of cathartic kind of laughs from the audience, but I was also getting a different kind of laugh, which is just shock because I said the N-word. And I stopped doing that joke. And the reason I stopped doing that joke is I noticed after shows, white fans or comics would come up to me and say, I love that sand N-word joke. And they'd say the N-word. And it's like, that's not what the joke solely was. And there was other parts. There was like three or four parts of that joke. But that was the part they seemed to want to focus on. And they would say that word over and over, where I would hear the N-word at least 6-7 times after the show, which I did not want to hear. And so it was effective in that I made the political point to some people. It was ineffective in that this was the what it created. And so I stopped doing that joke. I'm like, I don't need that. That wasn't the point. And if that's the effect, then I won't need to do it. So
Harry Condobolo is our guest. Did you make a link and a leap between human rights and comedy? Were they separate for you?
I definitely think that my political points of view feed into the comedy. There's no doubt. That's what being honest is on stage. And I don't own truth, but I own my truth. And whatever I believe, I want to make sure it's clear that the audience knows what I stand for. In terms of, like, let's say my human rights background, somewhat. I talk about immigrant rights a bit and you know, I try to bring in different things. But it's hard because I was reading a lot of theory, like really thick theory and learning about various human rights treaties. That's harder to infuse. Some of it's a bit heavy or a bit thick. So, yeah.
But if you came to Seattle on an AmeriCorps to work with the, I used to call them Northwest Immigrants Rights Project. So what were they called when you were working with them?
Well, that's a different organization.
That's a different organization.
Yeah, I worked with a group called Hate Free Zone. It's now referred to as One America. At the time, Premier Jayapal was the executive director.
Did you see comedy in the plights as well as the plights of the people you were working
Certainly. With? Certainly. I saw comedy. I mean, just in something as simple as the U.S. citizenship application. I used to bring the U.S. citizenship application on stage with me. And there would be questions on there about, basically asking, have you ever been a terrorist? Which seems like if you want to be a citizen, you would click no. So things like that, just going through the ridiculous questions that someone who is new to the country, perhaps struggling with English, trying to find their way in this country, has to answer to get status here. So, you know, there was always stuff. Especially when you're dealing with government bureaucracy, right, of any sort. But with immigrants, there was definitely a lot of stuff to be mined.
Well, but how did you start with comedy then? How did comedy become something you wanted to pursue?
When I was
Were you funny as a child, and kids said you're funny.
I was pretty funny, but I think I was never. I was more a comedian than a clown in a way. Like I was never the class clown. The class clown interrupts the teacher, doesn't pay attention, makes noises. Class comedian takes what the teacher said, tries to reconstruct it in a funny way, come up with an interesting question, comments on what they've heard. So I was more that. I noticed in high school at a certain point, though, like I would say something in class and nobody would laugh. And there was another kid, his name is Derwin, I remember. And Derwin would repeat what I just said slightly different with a few different words, huge reaction. And I would notice the difference between what a writer was and what a performer was, like those experiences. And started a comedy night when I was 17, and I did it for the first time, and I was hooked. Like, started a comedy night in my high school called Comedy Night. And still, like, I think about that experience and just how much I wanted that, like that feeling of sharing my point of view and having people laugh and feeling validated, you know. Sometimes I noticed with some of my topics, people might not always be on board with the politics and stuff. So how do you keep them in? You got to keep them laughing. So sometimes the performance has to take over. Even if they don't like the point of view, the performance has to take over. They have to like me. Yeah, we've all gotten into conversations with people that we don't particularly agree with them, but there's something about them. You still talk to them. You still like them. You know, that uncle who is saying god-awful things and is from another era, and you can't believe he still believes this, but man, he's funny. How is he keeping us interested? Like, I hate what he's saying, but there's something about him. And you can think about it later and disagree, certainly. But in the moment, he's compelling enough where you don't walk out.
You have that uncle?
I hope to be that uncle. Maybe not like his points of view are from another era, but at least I'm keeping your attention, right?
When you say people might not agree with my topics?
I really believe in kicking upward. I think there's more humor in it. I don't want to be the bully.
Well, do comedians succeed when they kick downward?
Yeah. Oh, man. There are people who laugh when bullies pick on people, certainly. And it depends on, you know, we see enough jokes about homeless people. I mean, if you're making a joke about a homeless person that isn't particularly thoughtful and is just about the way they smell or the experience you had with them that is not really treating them as a human but as a thing, that's kicking downwards. I mean, think about, to get into a comedy club, you need to have money. You have to have some expendable income that already separates you from a homeless person, like, big time, right? And so there's a power in that, and people laugh, and they don't see it as that, but there is no voice to counter that. And I remember going to comedy clubs in New York and always, you know, hearing impressions of Indian people and South Asian people being insulted, and we were supposed to take it. And I get the idea of taking a joke, but there was never a counter. There was never another voice. I would hear Apu on The Simpsons, but there was nobody else that was countering that particular image. And now there is an era where South Asians can say something. And I did a piece on Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell about that issue when Mindy Kaling had her show. And I was, you know, showing my excitement that she had a show, and the reason is because the history of South Asian representation. And so that power dynamic has shifted somewhat, because all of a sudden our voices have value. And they, to some degree, it's because we are a commodity. You know, we are a market, and people want to hear what we have to say, you know, because times have changed. So there's money in it, right?
You think that's not the only reason?
That's not the only reason, but that's definitely a big, if we weren't marketable, South Asians weren't marketable, if we weren't able to sell tickets or be a draw, there were South Asian performers before. You know, it wasn't, you know, there were South Asian performers who were trying to break through and they couldn't break through because the timing wasn't right. I know enough actors that had to play the parts of terrorists constantly because there were no real good parts for them, and they took the roles they could get. You know, it's about the time you break in. And we're in an era now that's more open and accepting, and people are more familiar with the South Asian because they grew up with them. Oh, they were my classmates and colleagues, and not just my cab driver and the person that worked at the store. And there's nothing wrong with those jobs. Those are noble jobs to me. Those are hard jobs. But, you know, there's so much complexity to the experience. So I think, you know, with the example I said before, there are no homeless comics. There's no counter to that representation. And that's where I feel like, well, we're laughing at somebody who's being kicked, but who doesn't have a reply.
I guess that's why I use the phrase comics are meant to. I guess because it seems like the best comedy, the best satire should always be, I'm using a rule there, if it's not valid, about kicking up and not kicking down.
Yeah, I mean, that's
otherwise
always,
it's not revolutionary, right?
That's right. No, that's what I mean. Lenny Bruce is still. I mean, you listen to Lenny Bruce stuff now, and some of it might not be funny just because of the time period, but certainly, there's still a lot of stuff that makes a lot of sense. Unfortunately, because we haven't moved as fast as I think we should. You know, some of the stuff he says about homophobia is still applicable to today. And Lenny Bruce is an example of somebody who really fought and tested those boundaries. And it's not to say everything he said I necessarily agree with politically, but I definitely appreciate the fact that he took those risks and he challenged authority, and it ultimately cost him his life. But, I mean, that's the role that comedians can play. And, you know, I don't aspire to die prematurely, but I do want to push buttons. I like it. I think it's important.
Hari Kondabolu. We'll be performing at the Comedy Underground tonight and tomorrow night. We have a link at our website for tickets. He's also a writer and contributor to a satire show on the FX network, Totally Biased. It's on at 11, where all the other satire shows seem to show up in the evenings. But that's the beauty of having TiVo. This is Weekday.
And now, the sound of the day.
What you're hearing is the sound of an RP30 Kodak professional printer spitting out hundreds of Santa Claus pictures. The sound is the conveyor belt that pushes the photos onto trays, the trays filling up and rotating to accept more photos. Weekday listener Jennifer works at Pacific Color in Linwood. They are a photo lab that prints professional school and sports photos most of the year. But between Thanksgiving and Christmas, their time is spent producing all the Santa pictures taken at Nordstrom's. She says sometimes that makes for a long Saturday. Side note, she also wants to encourage everyone to support small local businesses this Christmas. They are a company of only 5 people up there at Pacific Color in Linwood. So that's a great story. Thanks for sharing that with us. Share your sounds with us, your stories. Weekday at KUOW.org. The sound of your day, the sound of your life. We all want to hear a little bit of it. At least I do. I won't speak for the rest of you, but I'd like to hear a little bit of it. Send it to weekday at KUOW.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. What's the sound of the weather going to be? Well, we asked Nick Bond to tell us that. He is the Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. Hello, Nick.
Hi there.
Good to talk to you. How's it look for this weekend?
Well, it's a skier's forecast. We've had it got plenty of snow yesterday, at least a foot most places, some places 2 feet. It's continuing to come down today, and then it's going to taper off some on Saturday. So it's some of the best conditions up there for this time of year that we've seen in a long time. And around here, there's going to be cool weather, plenty of showers. We're kind of sheltered today in the Central Sound, but there's still a good chance of showers around. And some chilly evenings. One thing I kind of keeping an eye on is that some of the showers late tonight, early tomorrow morning on the higher hills, especially kind of North King County, South Snohomish County, might have a little bit of snow mixed with them. No accumulation or anything, but it might be kind of fun to see. And so, you know, we're getting blessed with a great weather pattern for snow. And that's going to continue into next week, a series of disturbances out of the Gulf of Alaska. And so it's definitely nice to get the snow now because you can never tell when we're going to shift to a different weather pattern.
What does happen? Remind me again, what is that shift? What happens later in this winter? Well, as we enter winter officially.
Well, of course, winter is defined by, you know, how long the day is. And the winter solstice is coming up on the 21st, and we only get about 8.5 hours of sun, and it only gets as high as 19 degrees above the horizon. But after December 21st, then the days get longer and so forth. People complain about how short the days are around here. Compare that with Fairbanks. This time of year, the sun rises at about 11 a.m. or so and sets before 3 p.m.
Oh, man.
And so, you know, it's not surprising that some Alaskans call winter the tunnel.
And what do you say? What happens by December 21st up there? How long is the sun in the horizon?
It's just 2 degrees above the horizon, and the day is just like 3.5 hours long or so.
Wow.
And so it's kind of, if you love the sun, Fairbanks in December is probably not the place to be.
So what's your sense of how long this this pattern, this clouds and sunshine pattern might stick with us?
Yeah, for the foreseeable future. And that's great from a winter sports perspective and snowpack perspective and all that. There is going to be a little brief warm-up on Monday, and the snow levels, which are now well below pass level, may creep up to about 4,000 feet, but it doesn't look like it's going to wash away much of the snow. And then more storms, impossible to time right now, coming out of the Gulf of Alaska and continuing to give us kind of a cool and wet pattern. No real cold air outbreaks, but plenty of snow in the mountains.
That's nice. So we're not going to get pummeled like we were by the rains of the past few weeks, huh?
Yeah. And in this pattern, the Seattle area gets protected by the Olympics to a degree, and so in some sense, we get the best of both possible worlds. We get the snow where we really want it and need it, and then here maybe you get to dry out from time to time. Still, there'll be plenty of showers around here, and temperatures will be kind of on the cool side with just low to mid 40s for highs.
All right, sir. It's good talking to you again.
Yeah.
Nick Bond is the Washington State climatologist, works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. Stick around, more weekday to come.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.